Today with Sarah McInerney.
Now, before we get on to the issue of schools, we want to look at a different story that was in today's Irish Independent. That paper has published details of the true state of Ireland's COVID-19 hit health system. It's in a briefing for the new Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly. There are fears of spiralling waiting lists, extra funding needed to fight the virus, and a potential €180 million shortfall in funding for the National Children's Hospital. I'm joined by Tony O'Brien, who is former head of the HSE, on the line. And Tony, you might just tell us your opinion really on the current state of the health service, because those briefing documents for the Minister Stephen Donnelly paint a very, very bleak picture.
Yeah, that will have been part of the Minister's welcome pack given to him a day or two after he was appointed, and they're intended to give a fairly sober, a realistic assessment of the state of play at that time, which was about 4 weeks ago. I think it reads from the media reports like a very realistic assessment. But it's also important to stress that's the default position. In other words, if things aren't done to improve it, that's what it looks like. And I have no doubt that both at HSE and Department of Health level, they're exploring every opportunity to do things differently to make that situation better, which would include more ambulatory care being provided in primary care settings, a lot more use of virtual consultation and e-health technology to reduce the impact on waiting lists. But we should be in no doubt the impact of COVID, and let's be clear, we're not in a post-COVID era, we're very much in the COVID era, means that the capacity of the health system in terms of physical capacity, the time it takes to carry out hygiene on imaging equipment and so on, reduces the capacity of the health system from what it was this time last year. And we know that this time last year, that capacity wasn't equal to the needs of our population.
Well, I think so that's going to be the real fear for people looking at that story today, where it's talking about waiting lists spiralling by as much as 130%.
And yeah, now that's not the numbers of people on waiting lists. And my interpretation of that is that that's the what would be called the clearance time. So a waiting list of X number of people may not have grown very much in terms of numbers, but the time it would now take to clear that waiting list, given the impact on health service capacity, has extended.
Also very worrying.
But it does mean that with the right types of investment and the right types of adaptations, and we've seen through COVID that the health service has shown itself to be very adaptive and capable of making change rapidly, that there are ways that that can be improved upon. But it would be wrong to diminish the very severe impact and challenge that the health service faces in the context of ongoing
COVID-19.
And
one of those
challenges,
it appears from the briefing document, is that there will be a need for a €1 billion further investment in funding, sort of a supplementary estimate as we see every year, but a bigger one than we've seen before. Do you think that's realistic? I'm sure you're well used to having to fight with the department to get the money. €1 billion at a time when we're looking at a €30 billion deficit, can it be done?
It has to be done. Let's be really clear. One thing that's absolutely been demonstrated this year is the direct correlation between the quality of our health service and the capability of our economy to function. The requirement to flatten the curve so low was in order to enable our health system to function. Had the health system had greater capacity, then that requirement may have been less. So there's a direct relationship between how we fund, organise and support our health service and the effectiveness of our capability to run our economy and therefore to recover from COVID-19. So I think that bad and all as everything has been this year, that's a very important lesson that I think needs to be remembered for the future.
All right.
Our health system has never had the right level of capacity for the demand, for the needs of our population. And if we can bring those two things back into balance, we'll be better able to deal with whatever might be thrown at us in the future.
Okay, Tony.
Be that the ongoing nature of this pandemic or another one.
Okay, you're staying with us on the line for our next discussion. Tánaiste the Leo Varadkar this week, when he was talking about the further easing of restrictions to phase four being delayed, said that we want to make sure that we do nothing that jeopardises the opening of schools and colleges in the next couple of weeks. However, concerns are being expressed about how to keep those schools open beyond the first couple of weeks of September, even if we do get them open in the first couple of weeks in September. So joining us now to discuss all of this, how masks, distancing, pupils' behaviour and indeed the role of parents will be crucial to keeping the schools open, are Breda O'Brien, teacher and Irish Times columnist, Colm O'Rourke, the principal of St Patrick's Classical School in Navan, Professor Cliona Ní Chealaí, who is an infectious disease consultant in St James's Hospital, and as I said, Tony O'Brien is also staying with us on the line, the former Director General of the HSE. And thank you all for joining us this morning. Tony, I might go back to you first and briefly on the issue of masks. Should they be mandatory in schools, do you reckon, all schools when they reopen?
Well, I think we should draw a distinction between primary schools, national schools and secondary schools because of the age difference between students. But it does seem unlikely that you can sustain an argument that if masks need to be compulsory in shops, barbershops, public transport and lots of other places, that there isn't an equal benefit to them being used, that or visors, whatever the case may be, in secondary schools where, you know, over 350,000 of our young people are going to be going into the most crowded situations they've been in since March. And at the moment, this question of masks being optional completely undermines the public health advice, which is that my mask protects you, your mask protects me. And given that we know there will be students going in who may not be able to wear masks due to health reasons, whose health may therefore be more at risk, how can they be protected if all of their peers are not wearing masks? And what does that do to the risk of exposures happening in schools, which may force closures and so on?
Okay. What do you reckon, Colm O'Rourke? Is it doable? Do you think you can you get second-level students to wear masks?
Well, I'd say it's doable. It obviously depends on the compliance rate among students, but we would feel that a visor would be a better option than a mask. A mask would be very uncomfortable for a young person to wear for 6 hours a day in school. And also the danger, of course, in secondary schools is that they would be dumped around the place and probably not washed. And so maybe it would be an even bigger health issue. So we think we will move to masks and see how they work. I don't think it's going to be very easy, but I think that people in general now accept that there is a need for these visors or a need for masks. The concern, of course, is that it appears from latest studies in Georgia and the United States and in Israel is that there is asymptomatic transmission is very common among young people, and that if it gets into a school, it will spread rapidly no matter what we might do. Mm. But we will take whatever precautions we possibly can.
And when you say you'll move to visors or masks, are you talking about making it mandatory in your school, regardless of what the government advice is?
Yeah, we are going to start off with visors for all students and see how that will work.
Okay. Cliona, visors versus masks. We've got another text in here from one of our listeners, James, also bring this up saying a face shield or a visor will be okay, but no to masks because they make communication, which is so important, too difficult. Are they okay or are they a lesser product?
We don't know yet. We know that masks reduce the risk of transmission by around 80%, so really meaningfully. And it's important to note in that outbreak in Georgia, for example, masks were optional. They weren't mandatory in that summer camp. So I definitely, myself and my infectious diseases colleagues would be advising that masks be mandatory in secondary school. We don't have enough evidence yet to say that visors are as safe. And at this critical point, I think I would be encouraging mask use wherever possible. Obviously, it is really difficult, particularly with younger children, to communicate well or people with hearing difficulties. So there will need to be a little bit of flexibility, but I think masks in the first instance.
Breed O'Brien, I know you were writing about these issues at the weekend. What's your view on what exactly kind of protective equipment pupils should be wearing?
Well, I'd go with Colm in terms of the visors. Obviously, I don't have the expertise that Cliona has, and I can see exactly what she's saying. But it may be that starting at least with face visors is better than having them sitting 1 meter distance from each other with no protection at all. It facilitates communication. It's interesting to see that face visors are mandatory for university lecturers. But if you think about it, some of the students that they will have sitting in front of them will be exactly the same age as some of the students we will have sitting in front of us. So it's really hard to understand why university lecturers would need them and teachers, for example, wouldn't. I think there's a wider point as well. The only way to keep coronavirus out of school is if everybody in society, people who don't have school-going age children at all, actually take the whole question of social distancing, hand washing, all of that very, very seriously. And in the case of parents, that they support the schools, that they, the amount of work that's going on in schools at the moment to try and get them ready to reopen. But the crucial thing is that they should be able to stay open. And I think the third point that I would really emphasise, and I haven't heard any discussion on it really, is rapid testing for teachers and students. There doesn't seem to be any dedicated facility for teachers and students. But even if people don't have the dread COVID-19, if you have a sniffle or a cough, you now have to stay out of school. And if, in the case of teachers, if enough teachers are notorious for coming to school when they're not completely well, but they can't do that anymore. And so unless we have rapid testing, people are going to be out unnecessarily and schools will rapidly become unsustainable under those conditions.
You're nodding, Cliona?
Yeah, I think I agree with Breeda 100%. Access, rapidly accessible, easy to access testing so that we can tease out who has a cold and who has COVID, get the people who have colds back to school, back to teaching, and those who have COVID rapidly isolated and contact traced is absolutely central to this phase.
And when you say rapid, are you talking about same day turnaround?
Yeah,
you
are. Same day turnaround. And ideally, small children will find the nasal swab or the pharyngeal swab very difficult, so we need to consider testing saliva in that instance, and there's good evidence emerging that that is an acceptable alternative.
Colin, we have a text in here from a person who says they're a secondary school student in Cork. I cannot fathom, says this listener, how I will get through the 9 to 4 day wearing a mask.
Yeah, I think it would be very uncomfortable. That's why I was saying that visors are probably a better option. And also, I think that the reality of school life, as most teachers would know, that if you have 30 or 20 or whatever number of students in front of you and they're wearing masks, there could be a difficulty with discipline, because it would be much easier for them to create noise and it would be hard for the teacher to keep control of that. So that's another issue, I think, which we would all be concerned about. And facial expression is important too, which of course is much better with visors than masks.
Who's going to pay for them, the masks or the visors, Colm, if you make it mandatory?
I think that the government, in fairness, have made a quite a substantial budget available to schools, and I think this would be a good way of spending the money. So I haven't any concerns in that regard, and I think that the department, who I have given a bit of a bashing to over the last few months, should be complimented with the amount of money that they have made available directly to schools.
Okay, and Tony, would you think that would be feasible for the HSE to fund PPE for all the schools?
I don't see why it would be a HSE responsibility. I think the HSE has enough problems. Clearly, it would be better if it was funded by the Exchequer through the Department of Education's vote rather than convolutedly through the HSE.
And is that something you think should happen, that it would be funded by the government, by whether it be the HSE or the Department of Education?
Well, I think most of the teenagers that we're talking about are going to have masks for their daily life, and it would be reasonable for them to use some of those in schools. But clearly there'll be some situations where the schools will need to have a supply of masks. I would go with masks rather than visors for the reason that Cliona has outlined. But also, if you look at the cost of visors versus masks, but there will, of course, be some students who can't tolerate masks, just as we've made exceptions for public transport and other places, and that needs to be taken account of. And obviously, it'll be important that break times are organised so the students can get out into the fresh air safely in situations where they can remove the masks for a period of time for their own comfort.
I texted in, Cliona, from Jerry wondering, is it safe to wear masks in class all day if they've been worn on public transport on a wet morning?
So the role of masks that we're talking about here is really, as Tony has said, to protect other people. So when you're wearing a cloth mask on public transport, or when I wear a mask at work, which I do for 8 hours a day, it's to prevent, if I have COVID and I don't know because I don't have symptoms, that I don't pass it on. So that same mask that you've worn on public transport into work will be able to do that same function while you're at school or at work, unless it gets wet, in which case it no longer works. So yeah, that's fine. And I agree, get them outside so that they can have a break from wearing their mask.
And what about younger kids then, primary school? Is that something that needs to be looked at or should be looked at or even could be looked at?
So it's really difficult. So actually, this morning we have a WhatsApp group of infectious diseases consultants and I was chatting with them.
I'm sure that's a fun WhatsApp.
It's a really fun WhatsApp. It's great. And that sense of collective support is amazing. But I had surveyed my six-year-old, who told me he could wear a mask, but he's seen me wearing masks a lot and we wear masks when we go to the shops. My infectious diseases colleagues didn't feel that primary school children, particularly the paediatrician, who I would really value their opinion, they felt that primary school children, particularly the little ones, wouldn't be able to wear masks. Interestingly, it looks like children under 10 may be relatively protected from disease. So I definitely think starting in secondary school and working down is a sensible way to go about things.
Okay. I know Donald Trump was talking about something along those lines, wasn't he? That children are immune from the virus. What would be your take on that?
So don't go to Donald Trump for your medical advice would be my essential advice. It's interesting because usually children are very strong spreaders of disease and do tend to get very sick with viral infections. And it's the flip with COVID. But we definitely can't say that they are immune. There have been cases of children getting sick. There have been cases of children transmitting it.
Okay.
Sarah,
I was about to come to yourself. Did you want to make a particular point?
I did. I wanted to make the point that schooling will be very different, and that it's you know, while it's really vital to get the schools open, it's as important to keep them open. But they are going to be much more limited. We're going to be going back to a much older and kind of less satisfactory model of teaching, because teachers can't even move around the classroom and so on. And it's really important that parents are supportive, and that, you know, that they help us get things like getting the homework in online if that's necessary, and so on. And I also think it's important to reassure students that, you know, people are working really hard to make schools as good an experience as possible, and not to be fearful about coming back to school, that people are really trying to make this safe and to make this work.
And on that, Breda, with all the restrictions in place, and, you know, even the primary school, the kids being put in pods and a lot of the group work being changed and all of that, do you think it'll be possible to really teach kids the way they used to be taught, or will there be an extent of just minding them and making sure they stay where they should be staying?
I'm no expert at all on primary level, but certainly I know there will be a lot of teaching going on at secondary school, and I would imagine the same will be the case at primary school, because we won't be able to use some of the, you know, the more interactive methodologies, like you can't pass out laminated cards and things like that, or, you know, it will be different, but there will be a lot of teaching going on. But another piece of the puzzle from an educational point of view is, what are the accommodations going to be for exams? And I think it's really a pity that we are not clear on that at this stage. The fact is, with the best will in the world, and with teachers working in some cases 60-hour weeks teaching online classes and so on, we still didn't get the same amount of the course covered as we would have liked. So for the sake of the students, we need to know exactly what the shape of the state exams is going to look like.
And you mentioned, Breda, parents then and their role in this, because the schools can do everything, can't they, that they need to do and have all the bits and pieces in place. But if parents are going on holidays or letting their kids go to house parties or whatever it might be, it unravels it all.
And it unravels it extremely rapidly. And it's not just kids going to house parties. It's adults behaving really responsibly as well. And people are going to have to make sacrifices. That may be unpalatable, but it's a reality. Sacrifices in terms of their social life, sacrifices in terms of their holidays. It's always only a minority, but a minority of parents, you know, will drop their kids to school having arrived from the airport the night before. That can't happen. All of those kind of things are going to have to change. Parents can't send their child to school, you know, with a sniffle or a cough, and other employers are going to have to be aware of that and to cut parents some slack. It's going to have to be an effort right across society, because this is such a serious issue. You know, if it gets into the schools, then it will get out of the schools and back into society and to those who are the most vulnerable.
Yeah, and Colm, I think most people would agree with what Breda is saying there, that this is what they'd like to see, you know, responsible behaviour by parents in relation to what their children are doing and indeed what they're doing themselves. But how do you control that from a school's perspective? If a family goes on holidays, will you be requiring the family to tell people, the school, if they're going on holidays, even to a green list country, for example?
Yeah, well, we will be communicating with parents over the next couple of weeks and requesting that they don't engage in any of this sort of activity, because if they want to keep their community safe, then we have to sort of operate in an individual bubble, and I know that will be very difficult, but the responsibility mainly lies with parents. There's going to be issues with, for example, school transport as well. People are going to be mixing from different schools on buses, so there has to be a sort of a cross community and a cross school engagement on this to try and keep our schools safe, because I think the experience is that if it gets into schools, it would spread very, very rapidly. So that's the way we must approach it, but the parents have the biggest responsibility of all in this regard.
And yet, Tony, parents have been told by the government that the green list countries are safe. They've been told not to go, but they've been told at the same time that they are safe to go to. So do you think it's okay for a family then to travel to a green list country and then they've been told by the government they don't have to restrict their movement once they're back? So therefore, you would say that the kids could go to school?
Well, let's be clear, the green list country is a short list of countries whose rate of COVID infection per 100,000 population is roughly similar or better than Ireland's. And the travel to green list is supposed to be for essential purposes, which could include dealing with family emergencies, important work issues or business or what have you. But it's not about going on family holidays. The guidance is very clear. Family holidays should take place in Ireland, shouldn't involve international travel, even to a green list country. And
well, the guidance has actually changed to say that it's not non-essential travel anymore when it comes to the green list countries.
But what was changed?
It does, yeah. It says two different things on the website, but I'm not surprised you're confused, Tony, because it says two different things on the website, but we're not going to get into that.
Obviously, I should have read the whole website. But exactly. Essentially, I wouldn't take my family on an overseas holiday this year. In fact, we should have been on one right now. We're not. I think it's just not a good idea.
Okay, just a final question to yourself, Colm, in relation to the masks. A texter says, in relation to teachers finding the masks uncomfortable to wear, as an ICU nurse, I had to wear far more heavy-duty PPE and for 12 hours, and we managed.
Yeah, but the point I'm making about masks is that apart from being uncomfortable, they do create a disciplinary issue maybe in some classes. And a visor, if it does the same job, and obviously we will take the health recommendation on that, it's much more comfortable, I think, for staff and students. And the importance of facial expression, both with teacher and students, is very important in a secondary setting, and you don't have that with masks.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for joining me this morning. That was Colm O'Rourke, Principal of St Patrick's Classical School in Navan, Tony O'Brien, former Director General of the HSE and columnist with the Sunday Business Post, Breda O'Brien, teacher and Irish Times columnist, and here in studio with me, Professor Cliona Ní Cealy, who is an infectious diseases consultant in St James's Hospital, with a very interesting WhatsApp group. Thank you all very much for joining me. We'll be back after this.
Today with Sarah McInerney on RTE Radio 1.